Now, when it comes to hyperinflation, I think the way people look at inflation, the way the mainstream look at inflation, is actually rather misleading. What we're not talking about is prices rising. We're talking about a collapse in the purchasing power of the currency. Now, when you understand the difference between the two, you can see how dangerous a collapse in the purchasing power of the currency is. You can see that it's something that you cannot measure. You can see that it's something that either happens gradually or can happen very, very quickly. And if we look at, for example, John Law's scheme exactly 300 years ago in 1720, I mean, basically, he puffed up the markets in exactly the same way as the central banks are now. You know, why are the central banks puffing up the market? Well, there are two good reasons. One is it makes us feel happy. And the second is the government needs to borrow money and it cannot afford a rising cost of borrowing. So you have got to ensure that the yields on government bonds do not rise. And that obviously extends to other things. You know, okay, what are the threats? Corporate bond yields. We must ensure they don't rise. So what happens? The Fed goes in and starts buying ETFs. And you've got various central banks around the world and sovereign wealth funds and all the rest of it going into equities, supporting the equity markets. So this is a situation which, just like John Law's Mississippi bubble, he only had one thing to puff up, and that was the Mississippi Company. And that began to fail, I would say, around about December 1719. There was still a price for the Mississippi Company shares the following September, but it had fallen from something like 12,000 livres. These are the livres that were printed, by the way, by John Law to buy the shares, fell from about 12,000 down to 1,000. But in the foreign exchanges, his livre was worthless. So you can see that in that case, there was a prototype doing exactly what the central banks are doing today. Just one country, one stock, compared with every country, every stock today. And what happened to the currency? Within a period of about 7 months, it completely collapsed. So I would not be surprised to see the same thing. And that's the way we should regard what's happening, rather than thinking in terms of hyperinflation.
The economy, markets, gold, and the trends. Turn off the fake news, let the real news begin. We're dropping truth bombs, no Keynesian. If you seek real knowledge, then keep listening. Phil is the host, got an MBA, homework and CPA. Economics, the Austrian way. Joker gives assistance. Revolution is now, we are the resistance. So follow the show, tell everyone you know, your friends and your family. KF's where to go to get real news and truth that's substantial. Sit back and relax, it's Kennedy Financial.
Well, good to see everyone. We're back at it live here on the East Coast. Kennedy Countdown, 3 o'clock, heading into the close. We'll see what the stock market does. In the meantime, many thanks to everybody tuning in. Hit the subscribe button. Don't forget to hit the notification bell. And also, don't forget to smash the like button. Thank you again to our supporting listeners, keeping us going, talking sound money, free markets, and real economics nearly every day. We got a big week lined up, and we're kicking it off right, as everyone knows from the thumbnail. Today's guest, Alistair MacLeod, you can find him at MacLeod Finance, head of research for Gold Money, educator for Sound Money, and demystifying finance and economics. Alistair, welcome to Kennedy Financial. How's it going today?
It's fine, and thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a real treat to have you on. I've been a fan of yours for quite some time. We've got a lot to talk about, especially since gold and silver are finally doing what they have done for centuries, and that is to protect people from government inflation. We got gold sitting at $1,750 here, according to CNBC. Silver at under $19 at $1,877. I might need to refresh my screen. Those might not be accurate, but that's what CNBC is telling me. Meanwhile, you penned an article that seems like it was a decade ago. It was only on May 23rd. Central banks are destroying what was left of free markets. You had a quote in here, and this is how I want to lead off the show. Today, through monetary debasement, nearly everyone benefits from monetary redistribution. This is not a costless exercise. Governments are no longer robbing Peter to pay Paul. They are robbing Peter to pay Peter as well. What did you mean by that?
Well, inflation dilutes the amount of money that people have in their pockets and the amount of money that they earn. And therefore, if you dilute the quantity, if you dilute money by increasing its quantity, then you are robbing everybody. It's as simple as that. And of course, the beneficiary is the government. And the government's cronies, big business, they're first in line to get the expansion of bank credit. Though I must admit, the bank credit side of it is not expanding at the moment. And if anything, I think the banks are very keen to reduce the amount of outstanding bank credit. So basically, the only beneficiary of this is the government, who then gives it out in, I don't know, defense spending, welfare, I suppose salaries for government employees, and so on and so forth. But the point is that we all pay for it.
So this is a show about Austrian economics, real economics. It's not a coincidence that this article gained my attention because it came over Mises' wire. I'm just an armchair economist, but I constantly talk about the fact that QE and artificially low interest rates led to malinvestments, a misallocation of resources. You're the expert here. Can you explain for the audience? I mean, this has been a long time coming. Guys like you and myself have been really trying to explain this for a while. The consequences of the monetary policy really didn't show its head until now. What do we mean by this? Malinvestments and misallocation of resources.
Well, malinvestments, basically, when you create a condition to encourage people to make an investment to benefit from the condition that you have created, instead of your anticipation as an entrepreneur of genuine consumer demand, then you are likely to invest on the wrong basis. It's almost certain that you invest on the wrong basis. Because what does an entrepreneur do? I mean, what is his function? His function basically is to supply what the consumer wants. And that comes about through the division of labor. A consumer might be, let us say, an expert carpenter. It might be a tradesman. He might be a stockbroker, whatever. He's got skills. And he concentrates on providing those skills to other people. He gets paid to do that in the money which is accepted by everybody. And he then goes and chooses what he wants to buy. Now, if you start corrupting the value of the money that he is paid in, then obviously you're going to introduce distortions into the economy. And one of the obvious distortions was really first highlighted, I think, in a more public sense by Hayek, who produced a triangle, and he showed on that how people are misled, businessmen are misled by lower interest rates. And undoubtedly, that's true. I mean, to a businessman, interest is the cost of investing in production, if you like. It is one of his capital costs, the other being labor. You've also got raw materials, you have got establishment costs and all the rest of it. But if you start monkeying around with the money, then obviously you're going to have problems down the line. And what tends to happen, a lot of this is the expansion of bank credit rather than in a normal cycle, rather than a central bank just pumping money into the economy. They might do that at the beginning to try and encourage the economy to grow. But basically, once commercial banks start pushing money into the system in the form of bank credit, then they really do distort the market. They start competing for customers. Look, you want to borrow money, but we want to lend it to you. Come on, borrow it, is the sort of mantra that comes out. So you go and borrow it. What are you going to spend it on? Well, you're not going to spend it on producing something really that the customers want, because you've probably already worked that out. You'll spend it on something else, and you'll spend it inefficiently. I mean, this always happens when you're offered money, rather than actually have to think very hard about where am I going to get the money to do this plan, then you're going to misallocate it. And that is, if you like, how you get the malinvestments occurring, investments which are not focused on providing what the customer wants. The customer is king. In order to survive, you need to satisfy the customer. If you start going off message, encouraged by a bank expanding its credit, then sooner or later, you're going to come a cropper. And inevitably, that's what happens, because later on in the credit cycle, commercial banks start withdrawing credit. And when they do it very suddenly, because they move from greed to fear. And when they go to fear. Suddenly they're not lending to anyone. And when you're sort of looking at, well, you know, I need a little bit more money to complete this project, it's not there. And furthermore, the bank says, you know that money we lent you? We want it back. And if you look at the fine print, we're entitled to it. So, and that is actually what's happening at the moment. I mean, the central banks are trying to stop the economy collapsing, you know, allegedly because of the virus, but actually it was already sliding down the wrong side of the credit cycle before the virus hit. So it's actually a combination of things which are really come to hit business. And I don't think the markets have yet sort of really woken up to how dangerous this is.
I've been talking about saving for a rainy day for a long time here on this show. It was wise advice from my grandmother who lived through the Depression. And frankly, when I was a kid, I really didn't understand what she meant. And I think all of us understand that now. We're being told that here in the United States, the savings rate is now at a 30-year high. But you penned the other day that in reality, Keynes' wish for euthanasia of the saver has finally been achieved. Talk about that. Why is saving so important and why don't we do it anymore?
Well, saving is the, if you like, the feedstock for investment. And in the bad old days of classical economics, when spoilers like von Mises were around, the idea that you could actually replace that just by printing money or printing credit, you know, it was sort of it really gained traction under Keynes in particular, though we were moving in that direction. I mean, at the time when von Mises first wrote his theory of the of money and credit, there was a lot of socialism around, and they were trying very, very hard to just sort of finance things by printing money. So Keynes wasn't the first to do this in that century, but he put in, if you like, a system whereby it was justified. And printing money really, at the end of the day, it actually transfers wealth, if you like, from all of us as individuals to the government. And so, you know, this money printing, it makes us all poorer.
Indeed it does. Thanks for all the nice comments from our viewers here. Alistair, we're getting a lot of nice comments. If folks would like to ask Alistair a question, get those lined up. And maybe, just maybe, if there's enough time, we'll take one call for Alistair. We have another quote here that I enjoyed in your article. And I've been using this term. I'm going to share it with you in a moment. But you write, "We can now say that America, the nation responsible for the world's reserve currency, has encouraged policies which have turned its economy from being a producer of goods with supporting services as the source of its citizens' wealth into little more than a financial casino." I've been calling the stock market a Keynesian casino. Here we are today. We see civil unrest, protests all over the country, and yet somehow the market is even or even up a little bit. I've joked before that, you know, a foreign adversary could nuke New York City and somehow the market would find a way to be up. You know, you called it a financial casino. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that the banks, instead of lending money to, if you like, the productive side of the economy, are using the expansion of bank credit very much for speculation. I mean, you look at sort of the casino that is COMEX. I mean, we see this in those of us who follow gold and silver and so on, see this extraordinary situation where they expand the amount of bank credit to finance increasing short positions, and then they pull the rug out from under the market when they deem it right. And they're very skilled at doing this. But what it means is that you know, you and I, who are classed as speculators, they're actually the speculators, but anyway, we'll let that one rest. We're classed as speculators. We go in, we have limited resources if we are speculating, and it's very, very easy to frighten us out of our positions because we cannot afford to put up the whole, you know, the whole money, the lot. But that is changing. Some of the speculators are now so aware that things are just not right and that market is falling apart, that what they're doing is they're standing for delivery. And that is very interesting. So instead of people, you know, putting down 5% or whatever the margin is and thinking, well, 5%, if gold goes up, X, I'm going to triple my money, you know, the greed factor. They're now in there, not for greed, they actually want the bullion. And there are huge amounts of bullion now being delivered through COMEX, which is something which COMEX was never really designed for. I mean, okay, they have to tie the future to the bullion by making the link that you can demand delivery. But does this often happen? No, we're seeing something really extraordinary.
Yeah, we've had Dave Kranzler, Craig Hemke, the GATA folks, Bill Murphy on to talk about the artificial suppression of gold and silver prices. We even had Stuart Englert on recently, the author of the new book Rigged, who penned this lengthy book about how long this fraud has been going on. He calls it the biggest fraud in the history of mankind. I tend to believe it, because what other commodity out there really never has to be delivered? And if you realize then later that they can create an enormous amount of paper gold and silver compared to the real physical that's out there, then it's the perfect scam and it's the perfect scheme. So, you know, let's talk more about that in terms of, you know, a lot of people have felt ripped off in recent years. You know, why would you want to buy silver? It's, you know, still in the teens. It was higher back in 1980. What do you say? I'm trying to convince people that no, silver is going to have its day. I think we're going to see three-figure silver down the road. How do you help convince someone that indeed gold and silver are still money?
I think you just have to ram the message home time and time again. A lot of the problem is that they look at gold and silver as something they call an investment. So we will diversify our portfolio by 5% by buying some gold, a gold ETF or something like that. It is not an investment, it is money. That is the message that you've got to drive home again and again and again. Now, once you understand it's money, then you behave differently. You look at it and you say, okay, this is money. Is it better money than dollars, or not so good as dollars, if that's your base currency? And you then make a judgment on that basis. So what you will see is the expansion of the quantity of dollars beginning to take off as the Fed does whatever it takes to rescue the economy. And they think they're just rescuing it from the virus. No, they're going to rescue it from the worst credit crisis, contraction of bank credit, that we have seen certainly since the 1930s, and probably worse than that. So the amount of money that's got to be printed, which is not backed by anything but full faith and credit in your wonderful government, then you can see that your judgment as to whether you should be in sound money, gold, or a fiat currency, dollar, suddenly you're beginning to make a sensible decision. So to my mind, what you have to do is you have to understand that gold and silver are money, why they are money, and why they have survived as money for the last 5,000 years while fiat currencies have come and gone.
You wrote another article recently, just 2 days after that, I really enjoyed, The Path to Monetary Collapse. It appeared on lourockwell.com. I love the title. In fact, I loved it so much, I named the video that our audience is watching right now with the same title. But I do run up against folks who say, look, you guys have been talking about the collapse of the monetary system and the world reserve currency status of the dollar. And then you turn around and you get on Zero Hedge and you see that there are lines around the world of people trying to exchange their currency for dollars and they're unable to obtain them. So who's right? Are we right, Alistair, or are they right?
Well, if you're looking at lines of people trying to get dollars, they've got an even worse currency than the dollar. It's the short answer. The one thing I would say is that if you read economics, you can see that way back from the 1920s, what's going on now is actually forecast as the eventual outcome of unsound money practices. So, I mean, on that basis, if you're hanging around saying, you know, an economist has said that money is unsound and therefore I should buy gold, on that basis, you might not have seen the catastrophe. And you might think, well, these chaps have been banging on about this for so long. Do I believe it anymore? And this is where we get to what you have said. But actually, if you look at what's happened since 1971, the Nixon shock, when we came off the last vestiges of a minuscule tie to gold. What's happened to the dollar's purchasing power? Measured in gold, it has gone down 97.3%. You have lost 97.3% of the purchasing power of your dollar against gold. Now, I mean, in sterling, we're in a worse position. That's the pound. We're 98.5-ish, something like that. The euro is quite similar to the US. It's done a little bit better than we have. And of course, you've got to adjust the euro because the euro only started in the year 2000 or 1999, 2000. So going back to 1971, you've got to work out the purchasing power of the various components in order to get a figure. The yen has done pretty well. It's lost about 92%. So now, when I say that the yen has done well, it's only lost 92%, you might sort of think, well, perhaps there's something in this gold story after all. And now we have a situation where all the major central banks are print, print, print. And they're going to have to print a lot more than they're letting on. So they're destroying the purchasing power of their currencies. And so, you know, you may have been waiting for this to happen a long time and you may have lost patience with it. But just look at what's going on. I mean, the moment has now arrived. And my own view, and you'll have picked it up in the articles that I've written, because I've tried to get the same outcome from different directions. And that is that I think there's a very strong possibility that paper currencies, fiat currencies, will not be here by the end of this year. The collapse, when it happens, can be that rapid.
A bold statement, but it wouldn't be unprecedented in financial history. And I think that's why Alistair is able to make that claim. And folks, you know, who follow me on Twitter at Kennedy Finance, I pointed out today in the last 18 months, even the Dow gold ratio is down 22%. It's 4 ounces of cheaper in gold to buy the Dow. So people need to continue to think in sound money. We'll go to listener questions. We got TMM chiming in. When does Alistair think this Keynesian craziness comes to an end? How will it occur, via bank failures or hyperinflation? He continues, is metals in short... Oh, well, that's a separate question. Let's just stick with that first one.
We'll stick with that. Okay. Yeah. So there are two questions. The first is... The first is the banks. Yes, the banks will have a crisis. Of that, I think there is very little doubt. We're looking at banks. If you take their capitalization and their balance sheets, so divide the balance sheet by the market cap of the G-SIB banks. These are the globally systemically important banks. You then get a measure of just how geared these banks are from the point of view of shareholders. And we look at something like Société Générale in France. That's about 120 times geared. We look at Deutsche Bank, that's about 80, I think. You look at, and it's been a lot worse than that, so it has recovered a bit. Look at our Barclays Bank, and that's about 62. You know, I mean, if you're 62 times geared on your shareholders, you know, the value of the shareholders' capital, then it doesn't take an awful lot, basically, to wipe out the shareholders' capital. And we now enter a situation where, because of the coronavirus, the downturn in the credit cycle, and so on and so forth, there are going to be massive bankruptcies. Banks are going to have to write off an awful lot of loans, what they call non-performing loans, which is a euphemism for a client who's gone bust. There are going to be lots and lots of those. Now, think about SocGen, 120 times. Wow. I mean, you know, they don't have to lose very much, basically, to wipe out capital. Nor does Deutsche Bank, nor does Barclays, nor do virtually all the European G-SIBs, because they are all very highly geared. The least highly geared are the lot of the American ones. But even then, you look at America and you sort of think, well, can we really believe their figures? You know, there are so many steps in this. There's so many confusions in it. But what you can see, just imagine that you're a director of a G-SIB, something like Barclays, let's say. You know, you've got a 62 times gearing on between your assets and your shareholders' capital in the market. You're going to be a very frightened man. You're going to see this business risking going down the swanny. So what do? You turn around and you tell everyone you can within the bank, we're reducing your loan book. We're reducing your books. Now, there's not a lot they can do with, if you like, the productive side of the economy. Yes, they can do a bit. But the idea of having a wholesale, you know, sort of, we're going to try and get our money back from everyone, will basically just collapse assets. So you don't want to do that. But what you will do is you'll say, in the derivatives, the FX swaps, you've got to cut that book by half. You say in interest rate swaps, you've got to cut that book by two thirds. You say in, let's say, the market making futures or positions held in futures like gold and silver, close it down. All we want to do is we want to just do client business and take no positions ourselves. So you've got to close it down. So you find that everybody throughout these banks are being told to reduce their exposure to whatever it is they're doing. This is very, very important. So we are going to have a crisis. Second question was about, incidentally, and I think in terms of timing, I would not be surprised to see a crisis within a month. Say by mid-July, I think it's quite likely that it will happen. And the interesting thing is that the markets are not putting anything into consideration about systemic risk. I don't hear anyone talking about systemic risk. I don't know, do you? Nobody's talking about it. When nobody's talking about it in this situation, I can tell you, it'll hit markets like a sledgehammer. Now, when it comes to hyperinflation, I think the way people look at inflation, the way the mainstream look at inflation, is actually rather misleading. What we're not talking about is prices rising. We're talking about a collapse in the purchasing power of the currency. Now, when you understand the difference between the two, you can see how dangerous a collapse in the purchasing power of the currency is. You can see that it's something that you cannot measure. You can see that it's something that either happens gradually or can happen very, very quickly. And if we look at, for example, John Law's scheme exactly 300 years ago in 1720, I mean, basically, he puffed up the markets in exactly the same way as the central banks are now. You know, why are the central banks puffing up the market? Well, there are two good reasons. One is it makes us feel happy. And the second is the government needs to borrow money and it cannot afford a rising cost of borrowing. So you have got to ensure that the yields on government bonds do not rise. And that obviously extends to other things. You know, okay, what are the threats? Corporate bond yields. We must ensure they don't rise. So what happens? The Fed goes in and starts buying ETFs. And you've got various central banks around the world and sovereign wealth funds and all the rest of it going into equities, supporting the equity markets. So this is a situation which, just like John Law's Mississippi bubble, he only had one thing to puff up, and that was the Mississippi Company. And that began to fail, I would say, around about December 1719. There was still a price for the Mississippi Company shares the following September, but it had fallen from something like 12,000 livre. These are livre that were printed, by the way, by John Law to buy the shares, fell from about 12,000 down to 1,000. But in the foreign exchanges, his livre was worthless. So you can see that in that case, there was a prototype doing exactly what the central banks are doing today. Just one country, one stock, compared with every country, every stock today. And what happened to the currency? Within a period of about 7 months, it completely collapsed. So I would not be surprised to see the same thing. And that's the way we should regard what's happening, rather than thinking in terms of hyperinflation.
We've had Lawrence Lepard on before. I imagine he follows you on Twitter, and he's probably a big fan, just like me. He has said that Ben Bernanke will go down in the history books as a modern day John Law. I would tend to agree, and I piggyback everything you just said there in terms of the methods that were used back then are no different than the ones being used now. They're just on a much bigger scale. Alistair's time is precious. We only have room for one more question. We'll take it from Vince here. Is it possible, just possible, that the COMEX is an arm of the Treasury to protect the dollar?
Well, this is a difficult one to answer definitively. But what I would suggest is that if it did not support the dollar in the sense that it rubbishes gold, then I don't think that the COMEX market would have had all the authorizations and support from the authorities which they have obtained. Can I put it that way rather diplomatically? But the underlying point is that if you expand the quantity of paper gold, paper silver, paper anything, then you dilute the demand for the underlying product. And that effectively is what the COMEX market does.
Well, this interview went extraordinarily fast, probably because I had so many questions for you. And it's a real honor to finally interview you. I've been following you for a long time. I've seen you in all sorts of financial education documentaries. Where can folks go to learn more about you, Alistair? And what's your final word today?
Goldmoney.com. And if you go there, there's a research tab. And under there, I write an insight article, which is published every Thursday, sort of early afternoon, Eastern Standard Time. And I also do a market report on gold and silver, which goes out on Friday at about the same time. My last word on this is, if you don't have some sound money tucked away somewhere, I mean, either at home or in a gold money account, then more fool you.
Indeed. Make gold money again. Hopefully we'll live to see it. And if not, folks should put themselves on a gold standard. Let me just close up here, Alistair, and I can say goodbye to you. Folks want to help the show, you know what to do. Give us a 5-star rating over on iTunes. That's how more people are going to find great guests like Alistair, learn about sound money like gold, free market capitalism, and real. That means Austrian economics. If we had those three things, I really think we wouldn't see a lot of the civil unrest, the protests that are taking place today. If you want to help the show, you know what to do. Many thanks to Patrick White for upping his monthly contribution. Just $2 a month gets you in our secret Facebook group where we're talking about all this important stuff every day. Lots of great guests lined up this week. Simon Dixon Moore. See you later, everybody. Kennedy Financial. Financial.